We'll hear arguments next in the Railway Labor Executives Association against Gibbons. Clark, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. About 18 months ago, Congress enacted the Rock Island Transition and Employee Assistance Act, and as it considered to be an integral part of that act, it added what it considered to be essential to rails continuation of rail service in the Midwest. It added an alternative employee protective program that it said should be made available immediately to the employees of the Rock Island who were displaced as a result of the demise of that carrier. That program was enjoined approximately 10 days after it was enacted, signed into law by President Carter. Congress readdressed the situation during the summer of 1980, and in the Staggers Rail Act enacted an amendment to the Rock Island Act, which was passed and signed into law on October 14, 1980. On October 16th, an order dated October 15th, but actually entered on the 16th, the District Court again enjoined the Act because it said the Staggers Rail Act was really only a cosmetic change in the law. It didn't change the substance of the Act. At that point, pursuant to the Railway Labor Executive Association, the appellant in these consolidated cases, had earlier taken an appeal to this Court from the June 9th injunctive order. That appeal is 80415. Once the Court entered the injunctive order on October 16th, RLEA took an appeal to the Seventh Circuit because in amending the Staggers Act, Congress had also amended where the appeal should go. So we went to the Seventh Circuit, and the Seventh Circuit was required by the Staggers Rail Act amendments to decide the case en banc within 60 days. It did, but unfortunately it split 3-3, and on December 16th it entered an order affirming the District Court's decision. The next appeal was then taken by RLEA to this Court, and on April 27th this Court accepted or noted probable jurisdiction in a second appeal, 1239 case, and deferred probable jurisdiction deferred consideration of probable jurisdiction in the first case. At the outset, I'd like to clear up one point. RLEA submits that the first case, 80415, the appeal was properly filed and timely filed in this Court. However, the Staggers Rail Act amendments mooted that case because the injunctive order, which is preventing the implementation of the Rock Island Act, employee protection, is actually the October injunction and not the June injunction. The June injunction is now moot, and we submit probable jurisdiction should be noted and the case vacated and grounds of mootness. Going to the questions that are before this Court, the first thing that the Court we submit has to address is the question raised in the noting of probable jurisdiction. That is basically what issues are before the Court at this time. We would submit that when we filed our brief, the only issue that was really before this Court was the question of whether or not the Staggers Rail Act amendments and the Rock Island Act had granted the estate a remedy or a means to obtain compensation. If compensation was available, there cannot be, we submit, an unconstitutional taking of property, because the whole substance of the what can be called the Just Compensation Clause or the Taking Clause of the Fifth Amendment is the adequate provision of compensation.
Mr. Clark, do you think that Congress, acting under its commerce power, can impair the obligation of contracts, which the state is specifically prohibited from doing by the Constitution?
No, Your Honor, we do not believe that Congress has that power under the Commerce Clause to impair the obligation of contracts. But the problem in this case is, first of all, is that issue really before this Court? That's basically in the taking issue. And the second point is, are the obligations of contract being impaired? And that gets into the question of whether there was a pre-existing obligation on a part of the estate, which we submit there was, and I'll get into that in a second or two. The trust, the creditors and the trustee below and the court below, the district court, found that the Rock Island Act affected an unconstitutional taking of property because the court indicated it came as a startling concept to him, to the court, that Congress could impose an obligation upon the estate and take $75 million to be paid to employees. As he went on to say, Congress does not have the power to take private property for public use. We submit that that is looking at the wrong part of the Just Compensation or Taking Clause. What has to be looked at, as this Court indicated before, is at the time of the taking, was there an adequate provision made for compensation? If there was, in fact, an adequate provision, even though the money is not paid up front, then there cannot be an unconstitutional taking, because the, as indicated, the gravamen of an unconstitutional taking is an uncompensated taking. And this Court has indicated in the Rail Act cases, and going back to the Cherokee case, the Kansas Southern. Yes, Your Honor.
Does everyone agree in this case that, assuming there was a taking in the sense that you're taking money out of the estate, that it was a taking for public use rather than a transfer of property from one group of private people to another group of private people?
Your Honor, I do not believe that everyone agrees to that. We have a problem with the appellees, the Rock Island appellees, and it's their position that Congress exceeded the scope of its authority under the Commerce Clause by enacting a private benefit for employees. They indicated as a basic, as Judge McGar indicated, a basic illogic in the Rock Island Act, which hopefully I'll be getting to in a second.
But for there to be a Tucker Act remedy, I take it would have to be not merely a taking, in the sense you take it from X, but a taking for public use. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a Tucker Act remedy, would there? If it's a taking from the railroad to the employees who are private parties, is there necessarily a Tucker Act remedy?
Yes, Your Honor. We submit if it's a taking as a direction of Congress by an act of Congress.
Even if not for public use.
Even if not for public use. If Congress believes it was necessary, it would not be a taking clause violation. You might have a due process clause violation, but as far as a taking clause is concerned, we would submit it's not a violation.
What is your authority for the proposition that even if it's not for a public use, there nevertheless is a Tucker Act remedy?
Your Honor, basically, if you take a look at the Rail Act cases where the court...
But there's a footnote in that opinion that says everybody agreed it was for a public use.
That's correct, Your Honor. But then in the part of the decision that had footnote 16 to it, the court talked about the power of the Tucker Act, and the Tucker Act being a remedy available for a taking that is authorized by the government. Authorized by the government is by the act of Congress. Here, Congress has specifically authorized the taking because at the time it acted, it believed it had the power to do it, and we submit it did have that power.
But you don't have any authority right on that proposition, do you?
No, I do not, Your Honor.
Well, do you read the Fifth Amendment to provide that in the event the taking is for private use rather than public use, no compensation need be provided?
No, Your Honor. If there is a taking, and it's not a taking, it is a taking. Now, this is discounting, of course, a proper statute, a regulatory type statute, such as in Turner and Ussery case. But if we have the only justification for the act of Congress is that it is a taking of property. We do submit that the Constitution requires that there be compensation for that. But we're not at that point. And this is the, what the appellant submits that, first of all, the only issue that's before this court is the question of compensation for the taking. And we submitted it was much simpler than the question seemed to indicate it is. Namely, the Tucker Act is there, and that solves the compensation issue. The question of whether there be, whether there is a taking or not is non-justiciable at this point because it is not properly presented in the factual situation where it is clear, a clear-cut, concrete situation, and that situation will not adequate, will not be presented.
And what's your submission as to where that should be determined?
And basically under the Tucker Act provisions in the Court of
Claims.
Yes, Your Honor, and I might clarify one thing. In our initial brief, we indicated that the taking issue can arise where either the creditors and the trustees sue and the government in the Court of Claims for the recovery of monies that were paid out pursuant to the Act. We submitted that a more likely scenario, however, would be that the creditors, the estate, would actually borrow the money from the federal government because Congress had provided that money there. And then the question of the legality of the priority that 110A granted to that debt would then be resolved either in the reorganization court or the Court of Claims.
Mr. Clark, it may be that if the United States takes property for public use, that the taking is not subject to an injunction because there's a compensation has been promised. But how about the situation where there is a taking, and say the United States, say we're taking your property, but we're going to take it for private use. And you can't complain now because you can go to the Court of Claims and get paid for it. We're going to take your money and you can get it back by going to the Court of Claims. And but the plaintiff then says, well, that rule may be just fine when the taking is for public use. This is for private use, and we should be able to enjoin you.
Your Honor, we would submit.
Do you have some authority on that point?
No, I do not.
I don't think you do if you don't have on the point that the Justice Stevens asked.
The only authority that might come close to that point is cases.
Well, that's what the issue here is. Should the district court have enjoined?
That's correct, Your Honor. And we submitted it should not have enjoined because the Tucker Act was available. And the this is not, for the Wilson versus New case is sort of on this one point, because in order to determine that Congress has taken property for private as compared to public use, you have to look behind the enactment of Congress's enactment. You have to look at the reasons that Congress did what it did. Now, granted, this Court has the right to see if there's a rational connection. But if Congress states in the preamble of its act that it's exercising its powers under the Commerce Clause to enact legislation which it believes has a public purpose, and that the act it is doing is simply compromising an obligation that already existed. And this is why we submit the taking issue when it finally does come up. Really, is not really an issue of authority.
The district court thought, though, that that it was entitled to give an injunction if there was a taking for private use. It seems to me the taking issue is fairly posed here. If you happen to agree that an injunction would be authorized in the event of a taking for a private use, then the taking issue is posed.
Your Honor, we're still back to was back to the question. It's not so much the taking issue, because the taking issue in this case is really when does a regulation become a taking? That's the ultimate part of the taking issue. One aspect of the taking issue here would be the question of whether or not the act that Congress did was public or private benefit. Now, one thing that has been sort of missed or not highlighted in this case is the actual factual situation, which leads to the conclusion that this was, in fact, an act of Congress under its Commerce Clause for a public benefit, a very strong public interest. When the Rock Island Act was being considered by Congress, it started back in February and March of 1980, before the abandonment order was even authorized to be sought for. That didn't occur until April 14th. And when Congress was considering what to do with the demise of the Rock Island and the directed service, which was to end on May 31st, at that point there was no more authority in the ICC to authorize any continued operation over that line. And the line would completely cease and all service would end at that point. So Congress had to address that issue. And in addressing that issue, Congress realized, as this Court has indicated from back in the 1930s, the interest of employees was an extremely important element in the perpetuation of that service. And in order to afford that, that employee protection, if you want to call it, that arrangements to help the people who are being affected and to preserve the public interest, Congress had to look at the interest of employees, which this court has again indicated is part of the national interest. And in doing that, Congress worked, and as the legislative history indicates, Congress worked along with labor and representatives of rail management. And the arrangement that came out of that combination of the parties was a combination of the Miami Accords, or the March 4 hiring agreement, and this particular piece of legislation. The basic logic that the court found in this legislation only comes because he's disregarding the March 4 agreement. The March 4 agreement is an integral part of the Rock Island legislation, and between the two, they provide a form of protection for employees who have spent their time in operating this railroad, who would then be available for continued rail operations over that line. It takes experienced people to operate a railroad, operate it safely and efficiently. And
keep, isn't that correct? The March 4 agreement related to employees who are going to continue to work.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Whereas this protection is for people who are terminated.
That's the second half of the protection. The protection to be adequate for an employee of a railroad has to cover the situation of an employee who is hired and an employee who is not hired. The March 4 agreement was to encourage carriers to hire people.
Right.
And then when they are hired, to give them some form of protection.
But is it not true that the benefits of this statute, if it's held valid, will all go to terminated employees, not to the same people who benefit from the March 4 agreement?
Terminated employees, but who are still available for continued rail service in that area.
Well, yes.
And
but,
there's another advantage.
But the purpose of it is to protect them in the event they don't get further jobs.
Yes, but that purpose, that's the immediate. I mean, that's the way Congress, the end that Congress used to accomplish its purpose. But its purpose that Congress said it was doing was to provide a protection for employees to enable the continued operation of lines.
But it just doesn't fit the facts.
But we submit it does, Your Honor, when you look at the agreement, the March 4 hiring agreement, together with the Rock Island protection, just like the Milwaukee situation. The Milwaukee Section 9 agreement combined with the March 4 agreement gave the protection for the interim operations.
Well, those are all for people who are still working. I understand that.
But not on the Milwaukee agreement, Your Honor. The Milwaukee agreement had protection for people who were not working.
Well,
and then the March 4 agreement protected those who were carried over. But there is a very strong public benefit that comes out of this type of enactment, and that's the fact that railroad workers do not have the type of pension systems that other people have, and their whole collective bargain agreements have protective arrangements built into it. Those protective arrangements have provided a sort of guaranteed security for employees that in the event of any cessation of operations, that they're not just going to be forgotten.
Is the Railroad Retirement Act gone?
It's not gone, Your Honor, but the benefits
well,
of these people.
I thought you said they had no protection at all.
The only protection they
well,
have
that is a protection, though.
$25 a day for 5 days a week. And those benefits are almost exhausted
something.
For most people. That's $125 a day,
it
$125
is,
a week.
It is something.
It is correct, Your Honor.
That's all I was trying to get you to say.
There is a protection of that sort, but the guaranteed job security that these people have enjoyed over the years guaranteed them more than that type of protection. It guaranteed them a different form of protection. It guaranteed them sort of a preservation of their jobs. And what we're facing here is a situation where Congress, when it enacted this legislation, believed that its earlier enactments had required that that be imposed in this case. And in order to make sure that that protection which it submitted was in the public interest being imposed, it enacted Section 106 of the Act. I realize my time is very nearly end. I would ask to reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal.
May I ask a question
yes,
without intruding on your time? Because
I appreciate that.
if it's all right with the Chief Justice, because your position in part is that this did not create a new obligation, but merely compromised a pre-existing obligation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Could you tell me what, in your view, the magnitude of the pre-existing obligation was, and was it larger or smaller than the new obligation?
Your Honor, it's hard to place an actual figure on it, but the levels of protection which we submit 11.347 require, the Interstate Commerce Act, which made mandatory here by 17A1 of the 17A of the Milwaukee Act, is that there be guaranteed income for 6 years with all cost of living adjustments added into it. In other words, 100% of your income for 6 years from the date of your effect. Or an option on the employee to take a separation allowance, which equals three, and for people with over 5 years of service, 360 times your last daily rate of pay.
And is it your position that the employees would have been entitled to that if this statute had never been enacted?
That's correct, Your Honor. Unfortunately, the Seventh Circuit has taken a different position, but the important thing on this is the ICC, up until 1976, always considered itself to have the discretion to impose this level, this type of protection in an entire line abandonment case. That in 1979, Congress took that discretion away. In 1979, it transferred the remaining discretion and the power the ICC had to authorize abandonments over to the Reorganization Court. And the legislative history in the Rock Island Act, prior to the whole confirmation of the abandonment coming up in the Reorganization Court, indicates that Congress believed that the 79 Act and the 76 Act, based on the 76 Act, had required that level of protection in this case. Thank you.
Mr. Stillman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Federal appellees appear here today in support of RLEA's appeal from the October order, from the Seventh Circuit's affirmance of the District Court's October order, holding an act of Congress, enjoining an act of Congress on grounds of its unconstitutionality. We regard the earlier cases moot. The federal appellees submit that the amended Rock Island Act does not, as the District Court concluded, affect an unconstitutional taking of private property. We make two basic arguments on this point. First, we submit that the Act does not take property within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment. And second, if contrary to our submission, the Court were to find that it did affect a taking of property, we submit that a reasonable, proper, and adequate provision for compensation has been made in the Tucker Act. And therefore, for two reasons, it was improper for the District Court to enter this injunction. Either there was an adequate remedy at law, or there was no violation to remedy. I'm going to address the taking question first, a question that we do urge the Court to decide in this case. And to understand why we're trying to say that this act is not a taking, you have to step back for a moment and consider the crisis that Congress was responding to when it was considering and when it enacted the Rock Island Act. And you have to consider also the legal and historical context with respect to employee protection against which Congress was also responding. The Rock Island Act did not, as the private appellees occasionally suggest, leap unannounced out of Congress's brow 3 days before the District Court authorized the abandonment here. In September of 1979, the Rock Island Act totally ceased operations over all of its lines. It was of critical importance to the Middle West, particularly to the shipment of farm products out there. And in months thereafter, this transportation system was held together just essentially by directed service orders given by the ICC. Congress was justifiably concerned with the effect of the liquidation of so large a railroad, not only on the Middle West, but on transportation services generally, on its ripple effect with respect to other lines. And the Rock Island Act, which was the congressional response to this, the Senate report on this issued in March of 1980. This act called for for the implementation of a plan, either negotiated by the parties or devised by the ICC, for providing limited compensation for those employees who were displaced as a result of the Rock Island's termination of operations. It further provided that the cost of plan would be charged to administrative expenses of the estate, that the benefits could be paid through federally guaranteed loans, and that there would be a maximum of $75 million. It could not exceed that amount.
But Congress didn't attempt to intervene in the proceeding to say that the Rock Island should continue to operate.
Right? No. It gave certain directed service
just
authority
accept,
to the
just
ICC.
Just accepted what the reality was.
Well, it was trying, what Congress was really trying to do here was create a situation which would encourage buyers for these lines. They want these lines to stay in business with other buyers. They've put money in the act for non-railroad carriers to buy some of these lines. They want they want the existing service to stay there to the extent possible, and the states want this too. And they viewed this labor protection, as Councillor Arellia has tried to suggest, as integral to holding the system together. And I think what he was trying to suggest to you here when he was talking about the March 4th agreement is that a large incentive for the union to enter into that agreement was that they assumed that Congress was proceeding along the lines to enact this other legislation which would take care of these other employees.
Well,
they regarded it, I think, as part of a package. That was one of the incentives. Now, maybe they would have been wiser not to sign this agreement in March 4th, 1980 and wait to see if the other thing would be upheld. But they didn't.
My suggestion, my question really is, do you think Congress intended to amend or repeal any part of the reorganization law?
No. I think Congress, what I would like to
didn't
say.
Didn't attempt to intervene in the proceeding to overturn any judicial
No, I don't believe Congress thought it was overturning anything. As the Council for RLEA has suggested, Congress, as they looked at the law affecting employee protection arrangements when they were devising the statute, what was on the books then affecting this railroad was the Milwaukee Act, Section 17A of the Milwaukee Act, which said certificates of abandonment shall include conditions providing fair and equitable arrangements for the employees. Shall include. It was absolute language. Now, it's true that there had been interpretations of that language as giving discretion to the reorganization court, similar to what the ICC had considered that it had under the 4R Act, discretion not to impose employee protection arrangements in some cases of whole line abandonments. But just as the ICC had always thought they had the discretion to create exceptions to their general rule that they wouldn't apply these conditions in whole line abandonments, that discretion remained here. There was a very real possibility while Congress was devising this legislation that this estate could have had imposed on it what are called the New York dock conditions. And that is a very high level of employee protection, which goes up to 6 years. And as to the question of how much liability there might have been here for this railroad, for the estate, if the New York dock conditions had been imposed, I think you got some idea of that from footnote 27 on page 52 of the private appellee's brief, where they discuss what happened under the Milwaukee statute. You know the Rock Island provisions here were modeled on Section 6 and Section...
Ms. Stillman?
Excuse me, a moment ago,
you used the term federally guaranteed loans.
Yes.
Does that mean that if the original obligor defaults and the federal government has to come in and make good on its guarantee, the government has recourse against the original obligor?
Yes. I think that money is put in escrow funds, but yes, I would say the government would have recourse. What I'm trying to suggest is that there was a very large potential liability here. Now, it wasn't certain whether it would be imposed. It was just, it could be imposed.
Well, it's now been decided that there was no such liability, isn't it?
Well, this is after the fact. At the time Congress was legislating this, there was
But you're not suggesting that the unions didn't really want this legislation, are you?
No, I will say that neither the unions nor the estate had any concrete, absolute guarantee that...
No, but there was a history of ICC total abandonments where they had not...
Yes, but the ICC had always said, well, we make exceptions in appropriate cases, and the ICC had
never... But the union really didn't want to take the risk. That's rather clear.
Well, there were risks on both sides.
Well, and the other Congress, side doesn't think there was much of a risk.
Congress addressing these risks, and I might say again, in terms of the amount of money that they were talking about here, footnote 27 of the private appellee's brief says that it was calculated for the Milwaukee Railroad that if New York dock conditions had been applied there, the liability might have been anything up to $1 billion. They say the best estimate was $350 million. The Milwaukee Railroad was roughly comparable in size to the Rock Island. I think it had a few more employees, but not very many more employees. So, and the ICC, in its recommendation report to the reorganization court when it recommended the approving the abandonment, they had a brief section on labor protection. They made no recommendation because they said, as far as we're concerned, this is being taken care of by Congress, so we don't feel that we should make a recommendation. They did note their policy of not having applied it in whole line abandonments, but they nevertheless told the reorganization court a viable option is imposition of New York dock conditions. That was very large liability, and Congress, looking at the state of the law, which would have permitted the imposition of that liability, simply said, we think, considering all of the factors here, the necessity to have labor stability, which will encourage other rail buyers to buy these lines. We think we also want to, by the way, encourage employees of other marginal carriers.
Was the March 4th agreement intended to enable sale of the lines by reducing the obligation of the employees?
That's true.
Mr. Gentleman, supposing the Rock Island had been a going concern, do you think Congress could have singled it out and said to its management, every employee on the Rock Island shall receive hourly wage of $5 an hour or more?
Well, that would be an exercise of Congress's commerce power, which also always would have to be tested for a rational basis as to whether that was a rational decision, a reasonable consideration of the class. I think it would stand or fall on that. We think here this was a rational response. The Rock Island was the only large railroad in the Middle West that was in these desperate straits. They were simply applying a legislative solution that fit the particular problem that they were addressing, a serious problem in interstate commerce, which they had every right under the commerce power to address. I would like also to address the question of whether this was just giving private property from one group of people to another group of people.
Let me just pose a question, because I'm glad you're getting that. In your brief, although I notice perhaps others wrote the brief, on page 19 you have the sentence, when a government regulation adjusting the burdens and benefits of economic life between private parties is held to be a taking, the government ordinarily should be given an opportunity to make a choice whether to rescind the regulation or pay just compensation.
You contend
this case comes within that sentence?
I think there are two ideas that are included there in the sentence. I think there's one idea that
Is this an adjustment between private parties?
An adjustment between private parties, which is critical to the public interest. And to address that point, what I would like to call the court's attention to is the case of Dayton Goose Creek Railway against the United States, a very early case which involved an ICE.
I'd first like to know whether you think that sentence applies to this case.
Yes, I think it
you
does.
Do, but
then I'd like to explain why I think that's
and
not a taking.
And you think Congress should be given a chance to decide whether or not, if it is a taking, they want to pay for it?
Yes.
And that they have not yet made an unequivocal determination on
Well,
this
let me say this. If Congress failed to act now and that money is paid out, and this court considers it taking, they'll be bound. I mean, there's nothing they can do once the money's paid out.
But it isn't paid out yet.
It isn't paid out yet.
And if we said there was a taking, you think you'd like to know whether it's a taking or not, so
that's
Congress
correct.
Could know whether to repeal the...
Well, that's correct, yes.
They have to act within 15 days, as I understand it, from our judgment.
Excuse me?
They would have to act within 15 days, would they not? Because if the injunction is set aside, there's a duty to decide the matter within 15 days.
Well, that's right. But then what happens is the ICC then has to devise a plan, and then it's approved by...
It's a rather accelerated time schedule.
Yes, that's true. There's some dispute, I think, between the private appellees and the RLEA as to how long it would take before you could get actual payments of money. But what I would like to say, going to this question of the private parties, in the Dayton Goose Creek Railway case, what happened there was the ICC had a regulation according to which they said, if railroads are earning profits over a certain amount, above a certain rate of return, we consider those excess profits. And we are going to require that they put half of those excess profits into this general fund, and this general fund will provide equipment and loans for other weaker carriers. And we see this as essential to the national transportation system. This court upheld that. Now, that was taking property from one party and giving it to another party, and the court found that a proper use of ICC power. Now, what we say here is that the money that was in the estate at all, $75 million, if you want to segregate it out, at all times existed under the potential liability under the Milwaukee Act, under Section 17A, of being awarded to the union under an employee protection arrangement. That was the state of the law. That potential claim existed there. All that Congress did was fix that claim at a lower amount and make it certain that there would be $75 million. So really all it did was amend the law to take what was potential, make it actual, and to fix it at a lower level. We don't see this as a taking of property. We don't see this as an irrational exercise of the commerce power, nor do we see it as to an intervention into the reorganization court's jurisdiction.
Well, do you see this case as one that within the Tucker Act, if we, A, said there was a taking, or B, we said there was not a taking?
If you say there is a taking, it's within the Tucker Act.
All right. So suppose we just pass the question, say,
the Tucker Act is there.
Would you, I suppose that would bind the government?
It will bind the government if they do nothing. If the money is paid out, if you say the Tucker Act is there, the money is paid out, and it later is determined to be a taking, and the estate has paid out $75 million, the estate would have a claim in the Court of Claims.
But Ms. Stem, what if we say it's a taking for private use?
Exactly.
Ah.
Then what happens?
This is a somewhat more difficult question because, of course, under United States against Teston, this court has said that there's no liability against the United States in the Court of Claims except where there is a right for damages, and, of course, the Just Compensation Clause provides such a right. We certainly would have to agree that if there were a separation of powers violation or anything like that, there probably would not be a money remedy in the Court of Claims.
In which event the question of an injunction comes up.
Yes, in which you can't invent. But we very strongly argue here that there is no serious question that there's not, in rational terms, some benefit to the public interest.
Do you think the United States would be foreclosed from arguing in the Court of Claims that it was a taking for private use and therefore the remedy is not available? I know you're the appellees here, of course, argue that the remedy is available because they don't want to get the money somewhere, presumably. But would not the United States have the right to argue, oh, no, this was not a taking for public use. There was evidence of congressional intent to make it administrative expense and not incur an absolute liability?
Your Honor, Congress made a finding in this legislation that it was in the public interest. Now,
was that the same?
That's not the same as the public taking for public use.
Oh. I think it is. I think the public. Oh, yes.
Supposing Congress made a finding that the General Motors could run the Ford company better than Ford does and transfer their assets to General Motors, that would be public benefit. Would that be a taking for public use? They said interstate commerce will benefit because they're more efficient and all that sort of public benefit.
I guess one reason this is difficult is because that's a sort of substantive due process test. And as
I think it's difficult because there's no precedent that
supports
your
position. Well, you have suggested, I think, in your opinion and more against City of East Cleveland, that what the court has done at sometimes in the past is apply what you call a fused test of a substantive due process test with a taking test. It's sometimes hard to tell which test the court is applying because to some extent when you talk about justice and fairness under the takings test, you're talking about some of the same factors that you talk about under substantive due process.
But if you're not talking about a real taking, but just a unconstitutional interference with property, then you can't avoid the injunction question.
Well, I don't...
Can you?
It seems to me it is so clear here that there's a public... That the public use of this money is the benefit to the public. The fact that it's being given to private parties just doesn't bear on that question.
Your avoidance of the question, as I take it, an answer.
Well, I'm reluctant to recklessly open up the treasury in the Court of Claims, but on the other hand, I don't want to suggest that this injunction should stand because we think clearly there is no basis for it standing.
May I ask this question? In deciding its position in this case, did the government give any consideration whatever to the position of the investors in this railroad, concededly bankrupt and unable to operate further, with assets of $204 million, and the government imposing an administrative claim of $75 million ahead of those investors?
Yes.
Do you think anybody would ever invest in another railroad if this can happen?
Well...
The government could, on your theory, the government could have asserted or approved or authorized an administrative claim, a brand new one, of $204 million. Why stop at 6 years compensation? Could it have been 16?
Well, under our theory, the existing law authorized the imposition of a much larger liability. Law that was on the books, law that the investors were aware of.
But is the government interested in encouraging people to invest in railroads?
Well, railroad investors...
Or does the government want to take them over?
Your Honor, I can't speak for the government on that
right.
point. But I would simply say that we believe that the injunction here was erroneous on both grounds, that it's not a taking within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment, and that it, if it is, the Tucker Act remedy prevents the injunction. Thank you.
Murray.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The principal issue presented in this appeal is whether by special legislation Congress can impose upon a bankrupt railroad already in liquidation a new obligation solely for the benefit of its former employees who are no longer going to be working in the railroad industry, an obligation that will displace the interest of the creditors and the shareholders of that railroad. This proceeding pends under Section 77 of the Bankruptcy Act, and this act has two purposes. First, the public interest in continued rail service, and secondly, and an equally important purpose, the conservation of the estate in the interest of the creditors and the shareholders. Now, at the outset of these proceedings, when they were filed in March 17, 1975, Judge McGar ordered the trustee to continue operations of the Rock Island. And at that time, he had to make a determination that the railroad was reorganizable and that the security of the creditors would not be impaired. And I would submit to the Court that if Judge McGar had thought at that time that there was a possibility of labor protection being imposed in the amounts that the RLEA and the government contend was possible, he never would have permitted reorganization to go on at that time. He would have stopped it right then and there, because the thought of imposing 6 years of wages, giving that to employees in the event of liquidation, would mean that there would be no way that the security of the creditors could be protected if reorganization proceedings would be ongoing. And I submit that that would be true in almost every railroad reorganization proceeding, that the proceeding would have to stop right there if a liability of that magnitude could be imposed upon the estate of a railroad. Now, in pursuit of these public interest objectives of Section 77, however, the Reorganization Court permitted the ongoing rail operations. And for 5 years, the trustee of the Rock Island paid out $1 billion in wages and benefits to the Rock Island employees, while the estate eroded in an amount in excess of $210 million. And in answer to Justice Marshall's question about the continuation of the Railroad Unemployment Insurance Act and the Railroad Retirement Fund, I should point out that during this time of reorganization, the Rock Island trustee contributed over $14 million to the Railroad Unemployment Insurance Fund and in excess of $100 million to the Railroad Retirement Fund, just as the Rock Island had done in years prior to reorganization. Of course, we have no question about the propriety of those contributions. As the reorganization entered its fifth year, three key events occurred, and they have been alluded to thus far in the argument. The first occurred in the summer of 1979 when the employees of the Rock Island struck the Rock Island, and as a result, it ceased rail operations, and on September 26, 1979, the Interstate Commerce Commission declared the Rock Island trustee cashless. And from that point forward, the trustee himself was not able to conduct any rail operations. The second key event was on January 25, 1980, when the Reorganization Court found that there no longer was any possibility of a successful reorganization of the Rock Island, and he ordered the trustee to commence liquidation. And really, from that point forward, the Rock Island's fate was sealed. From that point forward, it was clear that the Rock Island was withdrawing from the public interest service. Then, on June 2 of 1980, the Reorganization Court formally confirmed the total abandonment of all of its lines, and at that time declined to condition abandonment on the payment of any form of the so-called traditional labor protection. And that order was affirmed by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. It was just on the eve of that particular order that Congress enacted and President Carter signed into law the Rock Island Transition and Employee Assistance Act with its new labor protection obligation of $75 million. And that act, in essence, would impose a payment of 80% of a former employee's salary for up to 3 years, or a lump sum payment of each employee of $25,000, depending upon seniority. Congress stated the purpose of that act to be a public purpose, to continue rail service in the Midwest. But as Judge McGarr found, there was no connection between the payment of a lump sum severance pay to a former employee who was no longer going to continue in any rail service. There was no connection between that and ongoing rail operations in the Midwest.
This act didn't reactivate the operations of the Rock Island.
It did not reactivate the operation by the trustee. There was some directed service that was ongoing, imposed by the Interstate Commerce Commission, and that's the subject of separate litigation. But as of September, when the strike occurred, September of 1979, the Rock Island trustee no longer operated any railroad. That was the point at which the Rock Island stopped to all rail operations. We question the public purpose of this act because, in our view, it is not being paid to employees who are continuing in rail service. It is being paid to employees who are no longer in the railroad industry, who have not been employed by railroads who are continuing operations, other railroads. So there is no relationship. This case is quite unlike the Loudoun case, for example, which the RLEA relies upon, where there was an ongoing rail service by the Rock Island in one of its earlier reorganizations, and there was a rationale in that case to pay labor severance pay because that case involved a partial merger or consolidation. The railroad was ongoing. It was obtaining net income that was generated by the savings that were affected by the consolidation of rail service. And in that case, those savings, the court said, could be forced to be apportioned between the employees who were displaced.
Well, Mr. Murray, do you think
ICC could have imposed any kind of a termination burden on the estate
in the event of a total liquidation?
Yes, which
in event of a total liquidation, we would say it could not, and that is the position that the Seventh Circuit took. In connection
so you
with
just flatly disagree with the government's position and your opponents that there was any room at all in this reorganization proceeding to impose any termination pay.
That is correct, Justice White. We believe
no labor protective provisions were
in the event of a total abandonment by a railroad that was in liquidation. Now I draw that particular qualification because there are cases where a railroad that is not in liquidation might decide to withdraw from rail service, and it might be a perfectly healthy enterprise, and there might be a situation in which labor protection could be imposed. But that's not our case. Our case is one where this railroad has totally consumed itself in the public interest. And
well, if the Interstate Commerce Commission had some authority to impose some labor protective provisions in this case, on the facts of this case, it just had discretion to do so. Suppose it did,
yes,
and then Congress came along and said, well, we're going to exercise your discretion for you.
Well, I submit that in this case, they did not have any discretion in the context of a railroad in liquidation.
We have to decide that to hold for you, I guess. Don't we?
Well, I think that's an important question in this case, and I think the Seventh Circuit has already indicated its position on the case
well,
that there is no labor protection.
It's for us, too.
I understand that, Your Honor. And
How do you distinguish the Dayton Goose Creek case?
Well, that was a case where a railroad that was ongoing was required to share its excess profits with other railroads. And I think it's understood that all railroads operate in a kind of a community of interest. They operate their interline payments that are generated. There are all kinds of – there's a common carrier. There is a common fleet of cars. It's important to one ongoing railroad that all the other ongoing railroads are healthy. But that's not the situation of the Rock Island. The Rock Island is withdrawing from the railroad business. It's with the under the Brooks-Scanlon case, the creditors and the shareholders of the Rock Island cannot be compelled to continue their investment in a railroad for an indefinite period with a continuing losses. There has to come an end at some point to that. And that is what Judge McGarr held happened on January 25, 1980. So the Rock Island is withdrawing from that group of common carriers that have a common enterprise together, and I think that's the distinction of that Dayton case. The Seventh Circuit's reasoning has been followed by the court in the Third Circuit in the Susquehanna case and by the special court in the valuation proceedings case in a decision just handed down on November 24, 1981, in which the court stated that we would have considerable doubt regarding the constitutionality of Interstate Commerce Commission imposition of labor protection conditions in the abandonment of a hopelessly losing railroad.
Let me see if I understand your earlier point. Suppose a railroad decided that it was going to just cut off some of its outlying services, and the ICC approved, and a severance pay was ordered as a condition by the ICC. That would certainly be an appropriate corporate purpose, would it not?
Absolutely, that's correct, Your Honor.
Is there any relationship between that? Let me put it this way. I got an impression from you that if the railroad were an ongoing operation, you'd have a different situation with respect to the hypothetical I just presented to you.
We would be in the position, for example, of the Milwaukee Road, which is an ongoing rail operation, and it is in the process of contracting. And it does have a labor protection obligation under the traditional form of labor protection, and the Milwaukee Railroad Restructuring Act does benefit it because it takes what would be a larger obligation and scales it down. But the Commission has always drawn a distinction between a total abandonment and a partial abandonment. In a partial abandonment situation, the railroad has an interest in cutting back, scaling back that obligation. There is a savings that is generated that creates a greater net income that the ICC has said should be shared with the employees who have to bear the brunt of that loss. In a total abandonment situation, it's a loss situation. There is no net income from ongoing operations.
What if it's just a total abandonment, just a withdrawal, no liquidation, or no? It's not in a Section 77 reorganization, and it's not liquidating under.
I think that's the exception I posed earlier, that there might be a situation where a perfectly healthy railroad, for whatever reason, is withdrawn.
Yeah.
I think that's a different case, and perhaps, as a matter of statutory law, a labor protection obligation could be imposed in that case. Brooks-Scanlon and the Brooks-Scanlon precedent would not be operating.
So if the railroad says that we're going to withdraw from the railroad business, but we've got a lot of money, we're going to go to some other businesses. Do you think
that would be a different case?
Uh-huh.
And I think
that's not this case.
That's not the Brooks-Scanlon case. This is the situation in which this railroad has had massive losses over the last 5 years and is simply in the process of withdrawing and trying to provide for a liquidation, a complete liquidation.
Well, what about an employer who is in a losing situation when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed, providing for minimum wages? Do you think that he could claim an exemption because he was in a bad financial position?
No. As a matter of fact, I would say that under the I've already indicated in the case of the Rock Island was paying, even though it was losing money over the course of the reorganization, was making contributions to the Railroad Retirement Fund and to the Railroad Unemployment Insurance Fund. And I would suggest that is an instance in which there is legitimate investment-backed expectation, which is one of the tests under the New York Central cases, that is a legitimate investment-backed expectation that an ongoing business, even if it suffers a loss, has to make some contributions, for example, to health insurance or to unemployment insurance. What's so unusual about this case is that it was a retroactive obligation, that it was imposed in one lump sum and was utterly unprecedented.
But if the employer in Justice Rehnquist's example said, well, as long as I operate, I have to live up to the law, but it's too expensive, I'm going to quit,
And if he quit, it'd be a different question if the government then said, well, you can quit, but you're going to have to pay your employees for a couple of years.
That would be a problem. I think that's
well,
right.
Well, that's what you claim your case is.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. The government has argued that the Rock Island has benefited from the labor stability that was created in the case of the Rock Island, and we think this is belied by the record. In the first place, there was a strike by the employees of the Rock Island that was the proximate cause of its collapse. But in any event, we'd have to suggest that the Rock Island had suffered massive losses over the 5 years of operation, and how it can be suggested that the Rock Island benefited in this particular situation is quite distinct from the record.
We'll resume there at 1 o'clock. Counsel, you may resume.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. This morning, I alluded to the decision of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, finding that there was no labor protection in the Rock Island abandonment situation, and I would like to explain the reasoning that the Seventh Circuit provided and the reasoning that we have stated in our brief, which was filed before the Seventh Circuit decision. Labor protection arose originally in connection with mergers and consolidations. And the theory behind labor protection was that to the extent that a merger or consolidation resulted in a savings for a particular ongoing railroad and jobs were lost in the process, those savings ought to be shared with the employees who lost their jobs. Subsequently, Congress provided that labor protection should also be accorded in an abandonment situation. And in doing so, Congress cross-referenced the statute on abandonment with the statute on consolidations and mergers, and said that the labor protection that would be imposed in an abandonment situation would be the same as that imposed in a merger and consolidation situation. This involved the payment of the so-called New York dock conditions, which were applied in a partial abandonment situation, the 6 years of labor protection, 80% of an employee's wages. The ICC developed a consistent practice of exempting or declining to impose any labor protection in a total abandonment situation. And when Congress recodified the Interstate Commerce Act, it indicated in the legislative history of the adoption of that statute that no change in the law developed by the ICC respecting total abandonments was intended. And that same point was made when Congress transferred authority over abandonments in bankruptcy situations from the ICC to the reorganization court. And I should note it as an aside that in the Rock Island case, it is the reorganization court under Section 17 of the Milwaukee Road Restructuring Act that has authority and discretion as to whether to impose labor protection in an abandonment situation. But all the time that Congress was recodifying these languages and amending and transferring it, it always referred back to the language of the statute that it had been interpreted by the ICC as not requiring labor protection in a total abandonment situation. And that is what
the ICC, it was said it was forbidden?
The ICC indicated that they would not impose it. They did not say it was forbidden. That's correct.
Well, you're saying it's forbidden.
It's forbidden in the situation of a liquidation under Brooks Scanlon, where a railroad has operated at a loss consistently.
Well, the ICC's never said that. Nobody
that is
said
correct,
that.
Your Honor.
It's a new question.
It has been indicated by Judge McGar in his abandonment order, and that's correct. That is the one place it's been mentioned. The particular vice of the Rock Island Transition Act is that it attempts to retroactively impose labor protection in a situation where the Rock Island has already been adjudicated entitled to liquidate. This is not a situation where Congress is trying to enact legislation that will apply to all railroads or all railroads that subsequently enter into liquidation. Into reorganization, it applies only to the situation of the Rock Island after it has been adjudicated entitled to liquidate. The vice of this kind of retroactive legislation In part is that it impacts upon the creditors and the shareholders of the Rock Island because they made their investment in the railroad industry on the understanding that under this consistent ICC practice that had developed over the years, there would be no labor protection imposed in a total liquidation situation, that there would come a point.
That's true of all investors in any corporation prior to 1938 and the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, isn't it? They made their investment with the understanding that the company could pay its help as little as it could get by with.
It's true that that was the situation with the Fair Labor Standards Act, but what we're saying here is that this is a substantial obligation that's being imposed upon this particular railroad estate that has already served the public interest for 5 years with $210 million. In an ordinary situation, if a corporation, a non-railroad, went into bankruptcy, it would just go into straight liquidation. There would be no requirement that it continue in operation for 5 years with $210 million of losses. What is special about this case is that under Section 77 of the Bankruptcy Act, because a railroad has a partial public service obligation, this railroad has been required to continue operations, unlike any other corporation, has been required to continue operations for 5 years with immense losses. And it has served the public interest totally, and it can give no more to the public interest. That is the meaning of Judge McGar's liquidation order of January 25, 1980, and that is the distinction from any other non-railroad corporation under the Fair Labor Standards Act.
What if Congress in 1970, say prior to the Milwaukee liquidation, prior to the Rock Island liquidation, had said affirmatively there will be labor benefit programs for all railroads that subsequently go into liquidation?
That would clearly be a more difficult case for us. There would not be the same degree of retroactivity that exists in this particular case. This case is exacerbated by the fact that it occurred after the reorganization entered its liquidation phase. And the relevance of that point is that during the course of reorganization, this railroad amassed $250 million of expenses of administration. These are administrative claimants, small businesses, various group companies that dealt with the Rock Island on the assumption...
Lawyers.
Anybody that would be on the assumption that they would be entitled to priority under the Railroad Reorganization Statute, under Section 77, and under the very first order that Judge McGar entered in the case. Now, Congress, after the liquidation, is attempting to impose a claim that is either on the same plane with or prior to that, but it's going to have the effect of displacing or diluting those administrative claims, people who relied upon the provisions of Section 77 with respect to the priority of expenses of administration. And that will have an impact upon, if Congress can constitutionally impose such a prior claim at the 12th hour, you know, in the course of liquidation, that will have an impact upon the ability of the courts to conduct reorganizations where there is a precarious financial situation for a particular railroad or any company for that matter, because the possibility always exists that Congress could come along, enact a new statute, and displace the interest of the expense of administration claimants.
Well, are you really suggesting that the state is so depleted that it would not cover all administrative expenses, including the $75 million, if it is imposed?
Your Honor, at the present time, we do have some idea, Your Honor, that at the present time there are $250 million of expense of administration claims. There are between principal and interest, somewhere around $75 million of claims of first mortgage bondholders. And sales that have been made to date have been minimal.
So what's the estate valued at?
At the present time, the escrow fund amounts to approximately $130, $135 million, and there are no major sales pending.
But there certainly is a liquidation value on the remaining assets.
Except
you can't find any value in them, I guess. That's
correct, Your Honor. It's very difficult to...
So you're really saying if $75 million is imposed, if it's going to be paid in toto, it necessarily will be a priority administrative expense and will dilute the other claimants to administrative expenses?
At least dilute them and perhaps displace them, depending upon the priority that's accorded by the reorganization court.
Mr. Murray, how realistic is the $75 million figure?
Your Honor, we have in the record a affidavit by the trustee indicating that assuming 3,700 eligible employees, this appears at page 122A of the joint appendix, there would be an immediate payout of $46 million and a total payout of $69 million. That was calculated in based upon figures that were available in December of 1979, assuming 3,700 eligible employees. Subsequently, it appears that there are even fewer employees who have been employed by other railroads, and therefore the number is expected to be higher, so it would appear in all likelihood that it would be the full $75 million.
Counsel, assuming that the court were to find that it was not a taking for a private purpose, the railroad could then, would you concede, recover that amount that it paid out under the Tucker Act?
Well, assuming that it could not be, that this was not a for a private purpose, we would say that there was still irreparable harm to the Rock Island estate because this estate is in the process of withdrawing from the rail service and from the public service. And the effect that would have is to prevent a partial distribution that the reorganization court wants to make to the expense of administration claimants.
How long would it take to process a Tucker Act claim?
This act was passed over a year ago, and it's taken a year to litigate this. I would imagine it would take at least a year or 2 years, assuming the government raises certain defenses and there's a question about the amount.
So what really is the problem is that it delays a partial distribution.
That is correct, Your Honor. The real problem here is with the cost of administration payments.
What would be the difference between the interest rate that you'd get on your Tucker Act claim and what you could do with your money if you got it now?
Your Honor, the problem there is that there are cost of administration claimants, as Judge McGar found, who can't afford to wait for their money. These are people, businesses, who dealt with the trustee as they would deal with any other ongoing business, assuming they would be paid. And what happened in September of 1979 when the strike occurred and when the Rock Island became cashless is that it was unable to pay those expenses of administration that would be paid in any case, and those people are now being deferred. Judge McGar indicated that he receives letters each week from these people who are very necessitous, including local governments and state.
Why could the partial distribution not be made?
Because the escrow fund is not large enough to cover both the first mortgage bonds and the $75 million lien that would be imposed upon the estate, and that's why he's unable to proceed, and he has so indicated to the various cost of administration claimants who come to his court on each status report date asking when are they going to be paid. It's because the amount of this lien that's overhanging the Rock Island estate and will overhang it if it waits till a Tucker Act claim is prosecuted, that makes it impossible to make that partial distribution.
How about a partial pro rata distribution?
Your Honor, the difficulty with that is that, again, the escrow fund is not large enough to cover both the first mortgage bondholders and this $75 million so that there would be nothing left at that point or just a minuscule amount left for the expensive administration claimants.
What's the priority between administrative expenses and the first mortgage bondholders?
Your Honor, that has not been adjudicated by the reorganization court. It's a very complicated question, and I'm sure that's going to take quite a bit of time in the reorganization court. It would appear in some aspects of the expensive administration claims are subordinate to the first mortgage bondholders, but
a lot of them are not. To the extent that first mortgage bondholders have profited by it. I
would have to say that I think that most of the first mortgage bonds would be prior to the cost of administration claimants, but that's a question under Section 77, and Judge McGar has not ruled upon that, and you would get different answers to that question.
And needn't do so if the fund were large enough to cover both.
That's correct, and the problem there, of course, is you would get different answers to that question from different counsel for whom I'm speaking today, so I should make that clear. We are concerned, of course, in connection with the Tucker Act remedy, that it may not be available here because it is a taking for the private benefit of the former employees of the Rock Island, and we believe does not relate to a public purpose. The government and the RLEA has tried to indicate that some public purpose is served by this, but we are suggesting that the payments that are going to be made are not payments.
Counsel, would you say that in the case of an ongoing enterprise or even a reorganization of the railroad, that for the government to impose such liability would also lack a public purpose?
In that particular situation, Your Honor, I because the railroad remains in the railroad business, I think it would be a harder question. I mean, that would be a in fact, the court has held in RLEA versus ICC that it is a
yes, it was my understanding we really have upheld legislation of that kind.
That's correct, Your Honor. But there the thought is that the rationale there is the connection between the fact that a ongoing railroad profits from the partial abandonment that is affected and that the Congress can regulate the sharing of that profit with employees who are displaced because only a few employees have to bear the burden for which the entire railroad profits.
How do you deal with the argument that presumably the investors in the railroad understood that some liability might well attach in any event under the other act that was in force, the Milwaukee Act?
Well, I think they understood it to mean that if the rail, I think they understood Brooks Scanlon and the cases that have followed Brooks Scanlon, like New Haven Inclusion, to say that if a railroad operates at a loss consistently over the years, they have a right to withdraw their investment from rail service, and that cannot be subject to conditions such as the Congress tried to attach here. I think that's really the bottom line in terms of the constitutional right, that they assumed they could withdraw their investment, and they assumed that that could not be conditioned by the imposition of a large labor protection claim, particularly in light of the consistent ICC interpretation of the abandonment statutes. I want to address very briefly the question of the problem of this law as a non-uniform law in bankruptcy, because I think that is a matter that's of concern to us in this particular situation. One of the aspects of this law is that it does not attempt to generally amend Section 77 of the Bankruptcy Act to apply to all railroads, and it does not attempt even to deal with all railroads that are now currently in Section 77. It applies only to one railroad, which is the Rock Island Railroad. And the difficulty we have with that is, of course, that it permits Congress to tamper with an individual bankrupt estate, and we think that the vice of that is that we think there is some protection that exists in the Uniform Law on Bankruptcy Clause of the Constitution, because the framers required that legislation for one must apply to all, and it prevents some tampering with one individual railroad estate. And
was the Milwaukee reorganized out of the Northern District of Illinois?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Yes, it is. But the Milwaukee is in a different situation. In fact, the way the Act applied to the Milwaukee Railroad case was quite different than the way it applied to the Rock Island case. The Milwaukee was, when the Milwaukee Railroad Restructuring Act was enacted, and is now an ongoing railroad. And, of course, there was a partial abandonment labor protection liability there. We don't have that situation here. When our act was enacted, we had already been adjudicated entitled to liquidate. The government argues that this is a law affecting commerce and therefore is not they are not bound by the uniformity requirement of the bankruptcy power in the Constitution. The difficulty with this argument, I think, is that is twofold. On the one hand, Congress, almost every bankruptcy law attempts and involves in some way interstate commerce, I think one would have to say. And secondly, we think that just as the commerce power is qualified by other more specific constitutional provisions, and we think that's the case here. This is a more specific constitutional provision. Any law on bankruptcy must in some sense be uniform if a bankruptcy act can apply only to one railroad. That seems to us to suggest that the uniformity clause really doesn't have any meaning any longer. Another concern that this particular act raises is the disregard for the doctrine of separation of powers. And in that particular connection, I should note that this particular legislation compels Judge McGar to enter an order without any exercise of his own discretion, just immediately preceding the date on which he was scheduled to enter his decision on the particular matter. In a sense, this particular legislation dictated the decision only days before the decision was to be made. It is thus like United States versus Klein. It is unlike ex parte McCardle because there was no attempt to withdraw jurisdiction. They simply imposed a particular rule of decision on Judge McGar.
But if Congress had added the bottom line and said, by the way, to the extent the bankruptcy acts must be amended to achieve the above, they are so amended.
I don't believe they did that, though, Your Honor. That's,
if they had, it would be no separation of powers problem.
If they did it prospectively for all railroads and did it in connection with this?
I don't think the separation of powers means it has to be uniform. You rely on the Bankruptcy Act for that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The Bankruptcy Clause.
Right, the Bankruptcy Clause.
So it wouldn't be a separation of powers problem.
It wouldn't, but in this particular circumstance, what they did was they tried to dictate the decision. They said that the decision that the ICC would enter would be one that was fair and equitable, but what they define that to mean, whatever happened in the Milwaukee Road must happen here. Of course, the two are utterly unlike.
Mr. Murray, do you have any precedents for this argument to support you in this?
Your Honor, we have cited the United States versus Klein case. I would say that it's very rare that Congress has enacted a piece of legislation in this circumstance.
My question is, are there any precedents that you can...
The Klein case is the one precedent on which we rely, Your Honor. We are particularly concerned about the way this particular act operates when you combine the uniformity point that it operates only on one particular railroad and the fact that it operates on the eve of when the court was to make a decision and precludes a court's decision in a matter that is then pending and about to be decided. We think that raises very grave constitutional questions.
Mr. Murray, are there any specific authorities that truly resolve the question of whether this particular act may be said to be an act of bankruptcy, the act that we're considering that Congress passed?
Your Honor,
so as to bring into play the uniformity problem.
I don't have any specific authorities that I can cite to Your Honor now. I can explain, though, that this is an act that purports to create a claim, to adjudicate the existence of the claim, to state that the priority of the claim, it's talking about a claim in bankruptcy, and of course it only relates to a bankrupt railroad. It relates to no other entity.
Well, a railroad which is ceasing to operate. Maybe the bankruptcy stage is ended.
The bankruptcy.
Not sure. My concern is whether this act may properly be characterized as a bankruptcy.
Your Honor, my view would be that it's even more of a bankruptcy situation. Now, earlier there was some public interest component in this particular case. Now that it's in liquidation, it's in straight liquidation, and it really represents a pure bankruptcy just as any other.
This is a Section 77 proceeding, isn't it?
It is still a Section 77 proceeding.
Section 77 is passed pursuant to the bankruptcy power.
That is correct.
And this is going to be a plan of liquidation in a Section 77.
That is correct, and that is why it would be a bankruptcy.
And the question is, what claims are you going to pay?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's why we believe it's a bankruptcy act. I mean, it seems to us that the overwhelming component of this particular legislation involves bankruptcy, and to the extent there's any commerce implication for it, it's coincidental.
Mr. Murray, would you summarize again why you think the Staggers Act does not provide appropriate relief, assuming we find a taking?
Your Honor, our concern there is with respect to the fact that this benefits employees who are not former employees, who are not going to be working for other railroads. It doesn't serve any specific public purpose. It doesn't benefit the Rock Island in any way because the Rock Island has no pre-existing claim in our view. Therefore, we are concerned that the government could raise the defense at the time of a Tucker Act proceeding that it was not an appropriate matter under the Tucker Act. All the Staggers Act says is that a Tucker Act remedy, nothing in this act shall preclude or limit a Tucker Act remedy. It does not say whether, in fact, a Tucker Act remedy exists. It's very careful not to say that. The legislation is very careful not to say that particular point. The government, in their brief, indicates that there are situations where a Tucker Act remedy would not be available, for example, where there is no legislative authority for a particular taking, they say that that would not be an appropriate remedy under the Tucker Act. What we are saying here is that there may also be, there is no direct precedent on the point, but they may also raise the defense that this is not serving a governmental public purpose, and therefore there is no right to bring an action for compensation under the Tucker Act, and we won't know that until a later date, which will be preclude any remedy for us. We're not granted the Tucker Act remedy by that act.
Who would litigate the Tucker Act question? Would the trustee do it, or would creditors, or who?
I would assume that the trustee would bring the action on behalf of all creditors. Of course, if there's no Tucker Act remedy, then the money is paid out to all of the private employees, and it will be impossible to recover the money.
Well, I understand that, but somebody would have to initiate the litigation to determine whether or not the Tucker Act applied.
And I assume that would be the trustee,
yes.
But it would come on a later date after the money is paid out.
More administrative expense.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
More administrative expense.
That's right, Your Honor. What Judge McGarr wishes to do at this point in the proceeding is to conclude this liquidation as soon as possible, because the liquidation has already been ongoing for 5 years. This railroad has lost $210 million. It's amassed $250 million of expensive administration claims. He wishes to pay as many claims as he can and close the estate, get this matter ended, and he believes that that is what he is entitled to do, what he must do under the constitutional dictates of the Brooks family case.
Your concern is that if you were admitted to a Tucker Act remedy and you brought it, the United States may defend on the ground, no, there isn't any Tucker Act remedy, because contrary to the argument they've made here today, this was not for a public purpose.
Your Honor, I don't believe they've ever committed to paying the money in every circumstance, and I believe they're very careful in their brief, as I indicate.
Well, I have concern they might make that kind of defense, notwithstanding the argument here.
Yes, Your Honor, I would have concern about that. But there's also the point that there is irreparable harm to the Rock Island in that an estate which has already been existent in reorganization for 5 years with immense losses and all of these cost of administration claims, that is going to be prolonged for another several years while the Tucker Act claim is being prosecuted. And there's no reason for that. There might have been a reason for that in the 3R Act cases, where the government had to seize specific property to maintain rail service in the Northeast. Here we're talking about fungible money that could just as well come from the government, if in fact any public purpose is being served. We don't think there is. It could just as well come from the government as it could come from a bankrupt estate. If this operates as a taking, what the Rock Island is doing in essence is advancing money for the federal government, and that we submit that just doesn't make any sense. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Very well.
Mr. Chief Justice, I proceed, sir.
You have 3 minutes remaining.
Okay, thank you, sir. The one point that has been seems to be focused on and becomes almost like a central point is whether or not this act, the 106 and 110 of the act, create a private benefit rather than serves a public purpose. Now, we submit that the rationale given by the creditors for what is the whole purpose behind labor protection misses the mark. This court in the Loudoun case and then in the ICC versus the Railway Labor Executive Association case stressed that the only justification for imposing employee protection as part of the public national transportation system is to increase the stability of the labor force. And I'd just like to read one short paragraph or part of a paragraph from the Railway Labor Executive Association case, 315 U.S. 373. This is the abandonment case. There is nothing in the Act, namely the Interstate Commerce Act, to prevent the Commission from taking action in furtherance of the public convenience and necessity merely because the total impact of that action will include benefits to the private persons.
Mr. Clark, how do you distinguish Brooks Scanlon?
Your Honor, Brooks Scanlon has been interpreted by this court to allow a railroad to eventually withdraw itself from rail service. But until the public interest in continued rail services are satisfied, the public interest factor remains a viable consideration, and the railroad can be required to continue on even if there's an erosion of the interest of secured creditors. And that's in the
Well, certainly Brooks-Scanlon doesn't say that.
Brooks-Scanlon doesn't, Your Honor, but the New Haven case, I believe the Penn Central merger and the Denver and Rio Grande case, which you cited in our brief, indicate that the Brooks-Scanlon doctrine is qualified by the fact that all or railroad cannot be allowed to continue indefinitely at a loss. There can be a reasonable period of time while a public solution, a public interest solution is found. And we submit the difference that we have with the creditors and the trustee on this is that part of the public interest solution that has to be found here is how do you provide for a stabilized labor force. Now, the ICC case goes on to indicate that the Loudoun case specifically recognized that the imposition of conditions similar to those sought here might strengthen a national system through their effect on the morale and stability of railway workers generally. Exactly the same considerations of national importance are applicable and operative here. And we submit they're applicable and operative here as well, because the entire purpose of labor protection is not just for Rock Island people. It's for all railroad employees. Mr. Murray has indicated that the railway system is a national community type of establishment. What happens to me, what happens to one railroad here, affects another railroad, either through direct intercourse of commerce or through the passing of the word of mouth. If employees know that if the railroad goes bankrupt and they're going to be cut out in the cold unless they're lucky enough to get a job with somebody else, why should a railroad employee stay with any other carrier today that's in financial problems? It's because of that consideration and the need to continue railroad workers on their jobs and have that supply available that this continued. That's exactly what the Act did, and I realize my time is up.
Thank you, Counsel. The case is submitted.